Hello, everyone. I'm Sam.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Mo.
And this is Team Get Over It.
We're an all-female team participating in the greatest motoring adventure on the planet, the Mongol Rally.
We'll be driving 10,000 miles across mountains, deserts, and unknown terrain.
And along the way, we hope to spread our feminist and environmental ideals.
Join us here as we share our stories, thoughts, and interviews as we get ready for the Mongol Rally 2021.
Don't you mean 2022?
Shit!
Good day.
Hey, welcome back.
So in today's episode, we're going to continue with what we talked about last month. Women who walked the world, aka female explorers. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And... Yeah, and like last time, one of us did all the research and the other doesn't know anything. So Mo did all the research this time, and then she's going to tell me, or rather she's going to tell us, me and the listeners, about it. I'm so excited to hear about today's explorers.
So I'm excited to tell you. And yeah, so just like last time, let's go ahead and just jump on in, shall we?
Okay, got it.
Okay. All right, so I was looking at a couple of different websites that were generally just about female women in history.
Okay.
Which led me to the three women that I found for explorers in history.
Ooh.
And so they're kind of a little bit more famous and people may have heard of them before. And if you have, awesome. If not, hopefully this will be a little interesting insight into what women have been doing in the past. So the first woman we're going to talk about is... Miss Helenor Schmatz. She's from Germany, and she was a very successful mountaineering female in the 1960s to 1970s.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so she is really well known, especially for two other mountaineers, for her unfortunately fatal climb of Mount Everest.
Oh no.
Yeah.
That's sad.
So, unfortunately, that's why she's famous, but she was able to successfully summit the fourth and eighth tallest, highest peaks in the world before she made her trip to Everest, in addition to other slightly lower peaks.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically, I'm just going to kind of go over what, like, led up to her fatal trip and, like, kind of some of the things that happened around it.
Okay.
Because that was the most information that I found.
Is she one of those bodies that are still on Everest? Is she one of those?
She was. Unfortunately, I think in like 2007 or sometime after 2007, her body got blown off one of the cliff faces. And so her body has been lost. And so it's no longer where it used to be. Yeah. But for the longest time, and you can find photos of her mummified remains on the internet if you look her up, but her corpse sat for the longest time as like a vigil over the last base camp before people would summit the mountain, essentially.
Oh, wow.
So basically they applied for their visa to hike the mountain for their applications and everything.
Mm-hmm.
2 years before they actually got approval to hike, and during that 2 year period they hiked at least one mountain a month.
Okay.
Before to basically get themselves acclimatized to high altitudes and kind of reduce their chances of getting altitude sickness while they hiked Everest. So they were basically just trying to get their bodies acclimatized to all of the high altitude hiking that they were going to be doing.
Makes sense.
Or that they were doing for Everest, which led them to hiking Manlasu and Lotus, I think, which is the eighth and fourth tallest mountain in the world.
Wow.
Respectively. And so in June of 1977, they finally got their trip approved.
Mm-hmm.
And they started their hike, and they had eight others join them for their trip.
Mm-hmm.
So they had one guy from New Zealand, one guy from Switzerland, and one American joining them as well, in addition to two other German hikers. And she was the only female in their entire group that went.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Good for her.
And so it was them plus five Sherpas. that ended up going up the mountain in July of 1979. And it took them a while to, of course, get to the top. And it was, so in September, they were able to set their last camp at like the third base camp, basically, like the third highest place before, or is it camp four? I guess they call it camp four. But yeah, so it's basically like just below the peak. And it's like your last base camp where you can do the push from there to the peak and back down in like a day, okay. essentially. And so they did that. They set that area in September. And then due to bad weather and bad conditions, they ended up getting pushed back down the mountain. And they had to wait like a couple of weeks before they could try again. And so in October, they were able to make their way back up to that fourth camp that they had set up. And they were even split into two groups of three.
Okay.
So rather than traveling as a big group of eight, they split into two groups of three to try and like make it easier on them, I guess.
Okay.
And so Hannelore ended up getting broken up from her husband's group because they're generally hiked together.
Oh, that's a nice activity to do too, with your spouse. Yeah. I like that.
And her husband was like 20 years older than her.
Oh.
Right about. He was in his 50s and she passed away in her early like mid 30s. So she's like 36, 37. And he was 50 when he hiked Everest with her.
Fit guy.
So at the time he was the oldest man to summit Mount Everest at the time in 1979. Ooh. Nice. But yeah. Anyways, so basically from one of his blogs or comments, he was just saying that there were really bad snow conditions even when his group made the summit, and they had a really hard time, you know, just getting to the top of the mountain. So when they met up with his wife's group at that fourth camp before they went up, after they came back down from summiting, and they were like, hey, you shouldn't go up there, it's real bad, you should probably hold off for a couple of days. And apparently Hannelore was very stubborn and was like, no, I'm gonna go. And I'm going to do this sooner than later because, gosh darn it, I'm not going to get left out from being able to summit the peak. Like, I'm doing it. How dare you go, not me go, kind of thing. Is how he said she was indignant, is what he quoted it as. I was like, all right.
I respect it. I'm also very stubborn. But at the same time, when your life is on the line, like, I don't know,
bro. You got to know your own limits. So it's kind of like, how much do you take with a grain of salt versus how much do you like go, okay, would he lie to me? Would he try to prevent me from knowing this out of spite, or is it actually that bad? And kind of thing. So
yeah, I think she was probably like overestimating. It's probably a combination between overestimating her own abilities, underestimating the weather, and then also like just stubbornness, pure stubbornness.
It's pure stubbornness of, I'm so freaking close, I'm gonna do it.
Like, it's Everest, you know.
Right. And I get it, because I felt the same way when I hiked Holosan. Like, I was so close to the peak.
Oh yeah, you so gotta close. Gotta finish.
I could taste it, but we had to get off the mountain to make the ferry, and I was just like, there's no way I'm gonna be able to get up that last little bit with all the stairs.
If you come to visit in October, let's go.
Oh, hell yes. Yeah, so she was able to successfully summit Everest.
Okay.
And she was the fourth woman and the first German female to summit Everest.
Good for her.
Yeah. Unfortunately, on the way back down, and they're not really sure what the actual cause was, but it's probably a mixture of fatigue and altitude sickness and just being exhausted from hiking all the way up there. And you know how when you reach the peak, you're just like, yes, all the adrenaline just like wears off like 20 minutes afterwards. You're just like, fuck, I'm tired. Can I take a nap now?
Yeah. And your legs turn to jello. And yeah, I know that feeling.
And you're like, I still have, you know, 5 hours in front of me of hiking to get down off this mountain and go across the ridge. But I want to nap now.
Yeah, it's such a chore.
So I'm sure it was a combination of something like that that caused her to have extreme fatigue. And her and I think the American hiker that went with them both were suffering from this, and both had kind of like suggested or tried to, you know, make a stop in what they call the dead zone. So it's like the area towards the peak where it's really thin air, really cold temperatures and high chances. And this is like the area where a lot of people tend to die if they're going.
Yeah, it's called the dead zone.
For a reason. Yeah, no, I know. But anyway, so those two were struggling a lot and basically were trying to think of like where to rest, if they were going to rest. And unfortunately, the American passed away first, which prompted Hannelore to continue hiking and trying to make it down. And about 100 meters or so from where most people typically make their fourth camp, their fourth base camp before summiting in the mountain, she sat down, according to one of the Sherpas, gasping for water, water.
Okay.
And passed away shortly thereafter. Yeah. So basically her remains were sat above that base camp area where a lot of people pass, and she became known as the German woman because a lot of people walked past her corpse on their way up to the summit. Right. Because it was on the southern side, on the south side.
Wow.
Where a lot of people go because it's slightly less dangerous. And yeah, so sometime after 2007, her corpse got blown off the face of the cliffside that she was resting next to, and has been lost to the mountain since then. And that is Miss Hannelore.
It's a huge tragedy. That's really sad. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, what a legacy.
I know. And I'm sure there are plenty of women who were inspired as well as driven to be like, I'm going to do this because you made it, and I'm going to do what you couldn't do, which was make it down. I'm sure that there are women out there who were inspired by her story or, you know, wanted to prove to themselves that they could do it too.
Yeah, for sure. There must be.
I would, so, but I know there's no way in hell I would. Well, I wouldn't even make it to the first base camp. I'd be like, all right, I'm good. It's too far.
Yeah. Everest is kind of a problem because, like, I mean, like, I'm sure everyone's been kind of like following in the news and stuff, but it's like, I mean, getting a visa is so expensive these days, and there's so much trash. Like, so many people are going up Everest now that it's just like there's tons of trash everywhere. And like, even like, I think human fecal matter, because like, you know, like people are climbing and they have to take a shit and they just like they do their business and then it freezes and kind of like gets stuck. So there's like poop all over the place and there's trash all over the place. And then it's also kind of exploitative for the Sherpas. Like, to be honest, like, Sherpas like are the real MVPs. They go up and down the mountain like a couple times
a
year.
They're up and down that mountain all the time. Like,
yeah.
Why are they not getting any recognition?
Yeah. And they're the ones who are carrying all this stuff too. Like, man. So I think Everest is sort of every hiker's dream, but at the same time, it's also like a really big problem. But
yeah, I mean, they it's always touted as such an achievement. It's the thing you do to be like, I'm a world famous hiker. I did the thing. And I'm okay with being a hiker and being avid about it and like doing it because I enjoy it. But I don't think I'll ever hike Everest or hike any of the mountains in the Himalayas just because they're beyond my range. And I know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just expense wise, but also ability wise. I don't think I could willingly endure 2 to 3 months worth of hiking day in and day out.
Well, yeah, it's like, yeah, then it kind of, like, in my mind, like, I'm totally with you. Then it ceases to be fun. It's more like a job or a chore.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to do hiking like that.
Yeah.
I like just hiking as a pastime.
Yes. Being like, I'm done now. Thank you. I'm going to take 3 weeks off. Don't mind me.
Yeah, time to rest. For sure.
Alrighty. So the second adventurist that I'm going to talk about is Miss Bessie Coleman, who hails from Texas in the USA.
Okay. She sounds vaguely familiar. I feel like I've heard this name before.
Yeah. So she is well known because she is the first female aviator who is both of African and Native American descent.
Oh, I know who this – okay, now I know who it is.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so I picked her because, like, I had heard her name, and I know that she was a famous aviator, but I didn't know why. And so I just kind of wanted to do a little bit more of a blurb about her.
Yeah, I don't really, I don't have the specifics either, so I'm really looking forward to hearing about this.
Yeah, so she was born in Texas, and she spent most of her formative years growing up in Texas, helping her mother in the cotton fields, as well as with laundry to earn extra money for herself and her 12 brothers and sisters.
Oh, what? Oh, that's a big family. That's a lot of brothers and sisters.
She was born in 1892, so she was born in that era where it was still big families were a must.
Makes sense.
So she spent most of her time growing up in Texas, but she did have an opportunity when she finally reached, I think, 20 to move to Oklahoma and attend university. And she attended a college that at the time was known as Colored Agricultural and Normal University. And is now known as Langston University in Langston, Oklahoma. Unfortunately, she had to drop out after a single semester because she couldn't afford to continue attending.
That's unfortunate.
Which is unfortunate, but totally understandable because college is expensive. And I'm sure for a single Black woman back in the day trying to find a job that allowed her to earn enough money to attend college was difficult.
Yeah, that must have been really hard.
Yeah, especially in the South.
Oh, God, yeah.
But yeah, anyways, afterwards, she ended up moving up to Chicago to live with some of her brothers, and she became a beautician and worked in a hair and nail salon for a while. And around the end of World War I, one of her brothers was teasing her about how females in France and Europe were able to learn how to fly planes, but she wasn't allowed to in America. And so kind of with that egging her on, she applied to a bunch of schools in the U.S. to learn how to fly. But of course, due to the time period, all of the schools in the U.S. turned her down. Because she was both a woman and African-American. And then eventually she was talking to a famous African-American news publisher from that period, Robert Abbott, who recommended that she go to France to learn how to fly. And so she was like, that's a great idea, duh. And basically spent a couple of years, I think at least a year, taking French classes at night after work and everything like that to be able to do the application, which had to be done in French for the schools. And she eventually got accepted to the Cadran Brothers School of Aviation in Le Courtois, France. So she moved there to study aviation. And she learned how to fly and began making a name for herself with her aerial tricks and acrobatics.
Cool.
She was well known for her loop-de-loops and her figure eights that she would do.
That's impressive with, like, those planes. Okay.
Especially since those planes back in the day didn't have a top. They didn't have, like, the best safety harnesses.
I was listening to a podcast recently, and like the main focus of the podcast was this a guy in the United States, and he was flying planes and stuff, but like planes at the time, like they were described as basically like flying bricks. like they just didn't have the kind of like maneuverability or I guess like the kind of like design sleek finesse that planes today have. So being like loop-de-looping and like figure eights and stuff, that's very impressive.
It was very impressive, and she became world-renowned, so it's like she was very popular in Europe and did a lot of shows and performances there, as well as performances in the U.S.
Wow.
And whenever she did do a performance in the U.S., she, of course, and I love this about her, she pushed for desegregation. And so basically, if there was a performance or a venue where she was going to – where she was supposed to perform at, and they're like, yeah, we're going to have a segregated crowd, she refused to perform for them.
Nice. Good.
And there is one particular instance. Hold on. Let me find the article. I think it was around in 1925. She was going to do a show in Texas, in her hometown. But because Texas was still segregated, the managers of the arena planned to create two separate entrances for the African-Americans and the white people to get into the stadium. And she's just like, no, I'm not going to do that. There will be one gate for everybody, or I'm not performing at all.
Good for her.
Yeah, and eventually the managers of the stadium agreed on this one stipulation that the crowd still sit in segregated sections, but there would be one entrance for everybody to go in.
Okay.
And she's like, fine. I will take my wins where I get them.
Yeah.
So she did that. Mm-hmm. And in April, on April 30th, 1926, she did her last performance, and she didn't even do the actual performance. Basically, during the test flight, the practice run, mm-hmm. She went up with a mechanic named William Wills, I think.
Okay.
And he was the one who was flying the plane at the time. And unfortunately, I don't remember if it was a wrench. A wrench came loose while they were flying and got lodged in the engine somewhere and caused the plane to stall out. And he lost control of the airplane. Uh-huh. And it basically ended up flipping all the way over, upside down. And because planes back in the day didn't have tops, they didn't have a lot of safety harnesses and things like that, she fell out and fell
over again. No.
Yes. And unfortunately, the plane also crashed a few feet away from where she landed, and Mr. Wills also died.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that was really unfortunate. But she left a legacy behind of empowering women and African Americans to reach for their dreams and to, you know, not let anybody stop them. And she also was a great advocate for desegregation and African American and women's rights. In 1931, so a few years after her fatal crash, the Challenger Pilots Association of Chicago started to fly over her grave every year as a sign of respect.
Aww.
Yeah.
That's really sweet. So,
unfortunate accident, but great legacy and just a very inspirational woman of perseverance and striving to reach for your goals no matter what's put in your path.
Yeah. Man, I can't imagine.
It's like, imagine trying to go to France back in the early 1900s, back in the day.
Well, I mean, like, France has always been more, like, accepting and open-minded, I guess, of, yes. like, you know, different skin colors and ethnicities and races and blah, blah, blah.
Well, I'm just more of the arduous journey of just getting to France.
Oh, sure, sure,
traveling
sure.
across the states to get to the East Coast or get to Louisiana where you could get on a boat to take you around. To then get on another boat to go across the ocean.
Yeah, I guess
they didn't have international airliners back in the day, did they?
I don't think so. Maybe not.
I don't think international planes were like a thing until like the 60s or 70s.
Yeah, they probably didn't have anything that would reliably carry that much fuel.
Yeah, World War II, I think, maybe?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I don't know either. It's a good question. We'll have to look it up. Anyways.
For those listening at home, you can certainly look it up.
And let us know. We would love to know.
Leave a comment in the description or blah, blah, blah. Send us an email.
Yes. Yeah. I just love the fact that she, you know, was like, oh, I can't learn to fly here in the U.S. Everybody's telling me no. You know what? I'll just go to France and I'll learn French and do
it. When you were talking about that too, I was thinking, wow, that's really impressive. Like learning enough French, like in evening classes over the course of the year, because like French is ridiculous. And it's been like, I know after I learned French, they simplified the grammar a little bit, I think. It's like a nightmare. Learning French is a nightmare.
And I took French for a year in high school and remember nothing.
Yeah. I used to speak it quite fluently, but I mean, I haven't spoken much French in like 10 years or something, you know. They say if you don't use it, you'll lose it. So I need to refresh myself, but
yeah,
it's really tough.
I got to do the same thing with Korean and Japanese. I'm just like, "Oh, I feel myself losing my skills."
Yeah. Yeah, that's true too. But oh man, but yeah, I'm really impressed with her. Like she must have been like a very intelligent woman, like intelligent.
God, yeah.
Adventurous, because even like whenever you're doing those loop-de-loops and like, you know, doing different things in an airplane, you need to have like a very strong body because of the g-forces and stuff, even in those planes. So and like they didn't have flight suits back then, I guess.
I don't think so. I think it was just like leather jackets and like the leather ball cap.
Yeah. She's the total package.
Heck yeah. So while she may not be what a lot of people would call an explorer, she was an adventurer and worth mentioning.
Yeah. No, I'm glad that you brought her up because that's really interesting. Yeah. She's cool.
I started reading her story just on a whim and I was like, oh yeah, no, this is really interesting. And so I started taking notes. All right. And on to our last female explorer.
Mm.
She is an actual touted female explorer from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Fanny Bullock Workman.
Okay.
And she was born in 1859 and lived until 1925. So around about the same time as Bessie Coleman was alive.
Okay.
so she did most of her exploring in her mid to latter years.
Okay.
Before World War One.
Mm.
But yeah, so she was she was lucky enough to be born into a wealthy family in 1859 and mm-hmm. was able to attend the finest schools available to women at the time.
Okay.
So from that, she was a well-educated woman who had an interest in geography and cartography
mm-hmm.
and was also later became a writer and was able to write 8 books that were published with her husband.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so basically she, you know, lived your average wealthy family life in that time period. And then she married her husband. And with that, it allowed her to do a lot more exploring with because he was also fairly well off.
Okay.
So he was able to use his connections and wealth to allow the both of them to explore in Europe, in India, in Asia.
Wow, cool.
So they did a lot of their exploring and hiking in the Himalayan mountains.
Wow. Can you imagine like 1800s, Himalayas, Nepal? That would have been
probably
so interesting.
Beautiful, picturesque, and just so very different but similar to what we have today.
Exactly.
Because like a lot of the – I think a lot of the cultural stuff, things – a lot of their culture has stayed the same over the years, but like like most of the world has been modernized with technology and everything.
Well, yeah. And then I guess like too, like certain parts of Nepal obviously have been like, well, I mean, the whole world is like that, like, you know, catering to tourists and stuff. Like even my hometown is like all like, ooh, tourists in the summer anyway.
Which I mean, I understand because you got to make a living and it's a revenue vein, but I'm also just like, but back in the day, back when people didn't know about it and they hear about it from like their one friend or somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who know the person who did the thing, they're like,
yeah,
oh yeah, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I feel like such a hipster right now because it's just like, oh, I went there before everyone knew about it, duh, and like
right talking about it like that. Yeah, no, I feel you.
Yeah. But it must have been really something.
Yeah. So Miss Fanny or Miss Workman, she ended up gaining a really strong fan base through her publications that she did with her husband. And a lot of the fans really liked what they were talking about despite their flaws with the cartography and their bad grammatical errors and writing and just overall cultural insensitivity.
Yeah. I mean,
because to be expected. As one of the articles I read like to say, they herself and her husband were your stereotypical American tourists, loud, obnoxious, and very impatient. And I'm like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
But yeah, so basically she would use photos she had taken with her own Kodak camera to in their publications, and so a lot of people really liked those photos, and you know, continue to use them up until 1955 like references for where to go and specific points that are like really interesting or touristy locations to go to. Be like, ah, this is a must see area. Must go see that temple, or must go see that particular mountain peak or valley or what have you.
Wow. That's quite a long time to be using those photos. They must have been very good quality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking she probably was using photos from like from her Kodak camera from like 1900, like 1901, in that period. So it was a little bit more developed than the old cameras.
Oh, I mean, obviously, yeah, not like the big guys, but yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and so at one point, she and her husband embarked on a 2-year-long trip through through the Himalayas.
Okay.
Sorry. Through Indochina. So basically, they started biking.
Fun.
And they biked all the way up into, so this was in 1898.
Wow.
So she was, or I think William was 38 and Miss Franny was 50 at the time.
Ooh, what? So her husband is like 12 years younger than her?
I think so.
Atta girl.
I mean, the way that the article set it up makes it seem like that's what it is, because it's like, you know, how you do your age and then the names respectively.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they've got 38, 50, and then William and Franny Workman. I'm like, okay. She was older. Hey, get it. but yeah, so they did a 2.5-year trip that was a 14,000-mile cycling trip through Indochina. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have a whole lot of supplies that they brought with them. And they spent a lot of their time sleeping in railroad waiting rooms or just wherever they can find a place to lay down along the road. They spent a lot of time fixing tire punctures.
Oh yeah, I bet.
with their bikes, because back in the day they weren't that great. and at some point, they got rid of their bikes in northern India and just hiked over the mountain passes. And a lot of the passes were as high as 18,000 feet. And Miss Workman has been known to supposedly have broken female altitude records.
Oh,
at the
I
time.
Bet. Yeah.
I think they said that she set like 4 to 8 of them. I don't remember.
Oh, yeah, easy at least.
So supposedly she was immune to altitude sickness, which helped her with all of those high altitude hikes that she did, as well as tremendous resolve and skill and courage to help her through all that. And there's even an iconic photo of Miss Workman holding Votes for Women newspaper in her last expedition to the Himalayas, and she was on top of a glacier.
Oh, cool.
So basically it's her dressed in a jacket, a skirt with her boots, holding a newspaper and a hat, and like a really fancy hat with like ribbons and everything on it.
On a glacier
in the Himalayas at
nice
high
move.
Altitude. Yeah.
I like that. That's like a fabulous photo, because like, to me, like, I'm just picturing it in my mind, but it's just like, she's obviously like a very feminine woman, but she's in this terrain that, like, you know, I guess at the time people thought only a man could reach, but there she is. And then holding that paper, Votes for Women. And it's like, if I can be here, I should be able to vote.
Yeah.
That's a great photo.
Only, yeah. She definitely broke a lot of those stereotypes that men had against women being able to hike at those higher altitudes. She's like, look at me. I'm hiking just as well, if not better, than some of you men. So what's up with the stigmatism against women? And so she was really great for breaking down those barriers, as well as breaking what was seen as the British hold over the Himalayan hiking area.
Oh, really?
Like it just seemed at the time, according to one of the articles that I read, it suggests that Americans weren't really well known for hiking in the Himalayas. And her and her husband helped break that stigma of it's just Brits who hike in the Himalayas.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing, but
me neither.
Apparently,
I guess it kind of makes sense, because I mean, like, you know, British people owned a lot of the
India for a while.
Well, and they just like they owned a lot of area over there, like, because I mean, like, they had India,
yeah,
right. So it makes more sense that they would have more of a presence in that part of the world for sure. Mm-hmm. And America's so far away. Okay, but yeah, that's interesting.
It makes sense. It's just not something you would. It's not something you consider,
right?
I guess.
Yeah, I don't like. I don't automatically, when someone says Nepal, I don't think, oh yeah, British people. Like, it's not.
The British had control of that area for a while. Yeah.
Oh.
Exactly. Okay. So that is Miss Fanny Workman, and she just was really great at breaking those stereotypes. And while she may not have been the most well-written individual, she did publish 8 books about her adventures through Indochina and Italy and France and Spain and all over Europe when she was doing her hikes and her biking trips with her husband.
That's so cool.
I was even sitting here going, I should look up and see if I can find one of her books, but I don't know if they're still even out there. But
I'm sure they must be out there somewhere.
Maybe in an old secondhand bookstore.
Oh, for sure. Hopefully it's been like digitized and it's online somewhere. Like those kinds of things need to be preserved.
Yes, I agree. But yeah, so that is Miss Fanny Workman. And wow. She basically, after World War II happened, access to Europe and Indochina became very restricted for Americans. And so she basically spent the latter years of her life after that point writing and doing speeches in the U.S.
Okay.
So she's well known in the New England area in the U.S. for being a geographer, cartographer, mountaineer, explorer, and travel writer.
That's cool. I'm a little bit envious. That sounds like a great life. Seriously. It's so, how can I say, it's so like onerous to be stuck in like one place and to be limited, I guess. So like whenever I'm hearing about all these women who just kind of get out and they do what they want to do and they seem to enjoy like a certain amount of freedom. I don't know. That'd be so cool just to like be walking around or biking around somewhere and having no particular destination, just going. It's like, I'm tired now, and just like laying down at the side of the road and sleeping. And it sounds so great.
It does. It definitely sounds like something I would love to be able to do those kinds of things, but financially, I know it's not possible. And
yeah,
personally, I would want to do like kind of like what Fanny and Hannah Lore did, where they did a lot of their traveling with their spouse. And I don't necessarily need a man to travel with me, but I would love to have a partner to go with me.
Oh, yeah.
Be that man or female. Friend or
foe.
Life partner. Doesn't have to be life partner. Could just be a friend. I want a travel buddy, yo.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think like, I mean, you know me, I like to do things alone too, but maybe on like long stretches like that, it's better to have a companion because you might go insane.
Yeah, it's better to have a companion, like especially when you're traveling into countries where you don't necessarily speak the language with everybody, so you can't necessarily just stop off and be like, hey, how's it going, bub? And just like shoot the shit with whoever.
New friends.
So it's nice to occasionally have somebody who you can rely on and be like, we're experiencing this together. So, that's all we got for today. I hope you enjoyed learning about the female explorers I did some research on. I certainly enjoyed doing the research.
Yeah, no, I mean, aside from Bessie Coleman? Yeah, aside from Bessie, I didn't know about either of the other two explorers, and so it was very eye-opening and very interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I think probably very interesting to the listeners as well.
I hope so. And while I'm sure we left a lot out because there are tons. A ton of female explorers out there, I hope you guys are willing to go out and do your own research and just explore the women in history who are out there who have just been lost to time.
Yeah, because I think their stories are definitely worth hearing, for sure.
Yes. Worth hearing, worth researching, worth reading about.
Absolutely. And learning from. Being inspired by. So, and you know, if you did like this episode, don't forget to like, comment, subscribe, leave a comment, etc. on whatever platform you're listening to this on, as per usual.
And you can also support us by becoming a Patreon. Patreons have access to exclusive content, AMAs, and more. Proceeds will be donated to the Center of Reproductive Rights and Cool Earth. All links are in the description.
And of course, check out our website to read the accompanying blog post to today's episodes, read the sources. And, you know, shoot us a message when you figure out, like, you know, if planes were capable of transatlantic travel at the time, you know, back prior to World War II.
Heck yeah.
Don't be a stranger.
All right. Well, that's it for this month. And we'll see you next month.
Absolutely. Goodbye.
Bye.
That's it for today, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in.
And as always, please support this work by subscribing and donating to our cause at www.teamgetoverit.com.
Donors get access to specific content like stickers, t-shirts, and postcards from our journey.
You can donate for as little as $5 and the benefits build from there.
Go to our website for more info or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Team Get Over It.
Thanks for listening and catch us next time on Get Over It.
Because I don't have the button.
Yeah, no, that was all me, sorry. Okay, all right, ready?
Ready?
3, 2, 1.
And, Lotus?
Yeah, it's called the Dead Zone. People are climbing and they have to take a shit.
I'm gonna wreck this name. I'm relying on the French expert, that is Caitlin.
C'est moi.
Your stereotypical American tourist. Loud, obnoxious, and very impatient.
Atta girl!
Be that man or female. Friend or...
foe.
Life partner.
Oh, not bad.